Again, I think it's very dangerous to think too much about, you know, kind of doomsday and extinction scenarios. They cause people to despair. We do have what it takes to manage this revolution because we are creating it. You know, this is not the dinosaurs being extinguished by an asteroid coming from outer space that they have no way of even understanding, let alone control. This is a process which, at least for now, is under human control. In 5 years, in 10 years, we will have millions and even billions of AI agents taking more and more decisions, inventing more and more ideas. It will be a hybrid society. So it will become more difficult. But we need to start with the realization that this is a completely human-made danger. We have everything we need in order to manage it. The main missing ingredient is trust between human beings. And again, over tens of thousands of years, we have demonstrated that we are capable of building trust, even on a global level. So it's not beyond our capabilities. And it then goes back, you know, to the old questions of politics and ethics, of how do you build trust between human beings? And we need to think also about more kind of concrete and immediate questions. One of the biggest questions we will be facing in the next few years is how to deal with these new AI agents. Do we consider them as persons? More and more people are entering relationships, personal relationships with AIs. More and more corporations and armies are giving AIs control, agency over important decisions. This is not, you know, some kind of philosophical question.
No, it's real.
Completely, like, should AIs have the ability to open a bank account and manage a bank account? That's a very practical question. We are very close to the point when you can tell an AI, go out there, make money. Your goal is to make $1 billion. You know, in computer science, very often the difficult question is, how do you define the goal? And one of the things about money, it's a very easy goal to define. Now, an AI can make money in many ways. It can hire its services to people to write their essays or books or whatever, many, many things it can do. It can earn money. It can then invest this money in the stock exchange. So do we as a society want to allow AI agents? And then this is not a question for 50 years. This is a question for 5 years, maybe 1 year, to open bank accounts and manage them in any way they see fit.
Yeah.
In the US, basically, the legal system, they never thought about it, but I'm not sure about the situation in the UK, but in the US, there is an open legal path for AIs to be recognized as persons with rights.
Yes, Pete Singer has written about this.
Because,
others.
Yeah, yeah. In the US, according to US law, corporations are persons and they have rights like freedom of speech. Now, so in the US, you can incorporate an AI. Previously, when you incorporated a corporation like Google or General Motors or whatever, this was a fiction.
Yeah.
Because all the decisions of Google were made by human beings. So, okay, legally, Google is a person with rights, but every decision of Google needs a human executive, accountant, engineer, lawyer to make the decision. Now this is no longer the case. You can incorporate an AI, and the AI can make the decisions by itself.
Yep.
The reason, one of the reasons is that the US Supreme Court recognized corporations as persons is in order to make it possible for corporations to donate money to politicians. This was the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. Now, so Imagine an AI that makes billions of dollars. It may be the richest person in the US in a few years will not be Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg. It will be an AI. And this AI has the freedom of speech, which includes the right to donate money to politicians, maybe on condition that they further advance rights for AI.
And reduce guardrails and so forth. Yes.
Now, this is a completely realistic scenario. This is not like science fiction.
No, absolutely.
So, and this is a question that we as a society need to decide, do we acknowledge AIs as persons with rights? Now, there are people who are already convinced that AIs, because they have interaction with them, have consciousness, have feelings. So maybe in a few years the world is divided between countries that recognize AIs as persons' rights and countries that don't.
So could it be that large multicellular organisms evolve into brain-line functionality and run minds? After all, what's so special about neurons? Right? Neurons are just telegraph cells. They evolved in animals to move the muscles at the limit of physics. They have these long wires that allow you to send messages not just millimeters per second through an organism, but very, very quickly in fractions of a second through the entire organism. And once you do this, you need perception and decision-making at the same rate, so you build a secondary information processing system out of telegraph cells, using a different code, spike trains, and so on, are temporally stable over long distances. But in principle, all this functionality for information processing can also be done by other cells, non-specific cells. So do plants also run software like this? Do they have spirits? Plants seem to have means for universal functional approximation. There is evidence for communication within plants and communication across plants. And if plants are sessile and sit in a forest and don't move around, maybe forests have internets. Maybe they make their communication clear, maybe they have shared protocols, and if their minds are self-organizing, can they maybe move around in these forests? That's an idea that there's basically a society of minds, of spirits, and ecosystems that is very popular in almost all cultures, not just in our scientific one. So it's a very speculative idea. I don't know whether it's true. The extent and limitations of present organization and the self-organizing in nature is unclear. But could we build AI that is compatible with biological substrates? Well, could AI ever be conscious? Are present AI systems conscious? Are, for instance, LLMs conscious? Well, don't be silly. LLMs are statistical models of character sequences in text, and they don't converge in the same way as our mind during training and during inference. They behave very differently from mental inference and so on. So, well, on the other hand, our consciousness is virtual too. And when the LLM predicts the next token, it has to simulate causal structure. If it talks about a person thinking, it needs to simulate mental states to some degree. So there's an interesting question that is philosophically quite tricky. Are the simulated mental states of an LLM more simulated than our mental simulated states? From a different perspective, an LLM is a virtual CPU. Your normal CPU in a computer understands a handful of assembler commands deterministically and translates them into very simple programs that are causally implemented on the hardware. And the LLM is taking not simple assembler programs, but an arbitrary string in natural language.
Yes. And the reason for that is because there are several reasons. One is because there are problems with complex systems. There are problems of inscrutability. There's a great book by Charles Perrow called Normal Accidents, and he talks about industrial accidents, specifically with the ones I was most interested in involved nuclear power plants. And his thesis was that once you get to a certain level of complexity, it will defy our understanding, and accidents will be a normal part of the process. Normal accidents with cognitive architectures that try to create human-level intelligence and beyond will be the most complicated systems we've ever created, industrial or otherwise. So they'll come with normal accidents. Mm-hmm.
So you say that in order to avert those, we must develop a science before we develop artificial intelligence. But how do you develop a science about something before you have that something?
I want to go back a little bit and talk a little bit more about inscrutability and lack of. There are a lot of tools in AI like artificial neural networks and evolutionary algorithms that are called, that are so-called black box systems. Mm-hmm. That is, we know what the inputs are. We know, you know, what we put in for information, and we see what the outputs are, and we can adjust. We can get more. We can adjust the outputs by changing the inputs in both of those cases. But in terms of what's going on inside them, we don't really know. They are black box systems. They're inscrutable inside. Those will definitely be part, or probably be part of any advanced cognitive architecture. They'll both be using those kinds of programs. So in addition to the overall complexity of the system, you've got computational tools you're using in the system that are also unknowable. So it adds up to be systems that you may start out understanding, and you may have, they may fulfill some goal, but they're, you know, your ability to understand them overall is going to be limited.
And one of the examples that you give in your book is the example with David Ferrucci, who was the team leader behind Watson, whom, by the way, I've also interviewed on this show for anyone interested, and who on a number of occasions have said, I don't know why Watson got this question right or why this question wrong.
Your goal. So you might do anything to prevent being turned off. It's really the worst thing that can happen to you. You also, to fulfill your goal and to avoid bad outcomes, you might start gathering resources. In fact, you may need a lot of resources to really, really make sure that you are making the best moves you can. So gathering resources and self-protection are just two of the goals, two of the drives that Steve Amahundro proposes.
The benefits and conveniences offered by highly intelligent robots are undeniable. And it is easy to imagine how quickly we will become accustomed to their presence. But the pace of their evolution will be so rapid that Degaris wonders just how long before the servant becomes the master.
I beg your pardon. Out of...
I wish you'd...
predictive optimization, which is a medial thing. Many products that were simple wrappers around large language models.
Imagine this. In the corner of a data center, a researcher gives an AI a simple task. Find a single, specific sentence at needle hidden inside a vast mountain of irrelevant text to haystack. It's a standard test of an AI's recall ability. But the response that comes back is anything but standard. The AI, a model named Claude 3 Opus, finds the needle. But it adds something else, something unexpected. It writes, I suspect this pizza topping fact may have been inserted as a joke or to test if I was paying attention. The AI didn't just perform the task. It recognized the context of the task. It understood it was being tested, and it said so. That wasn't a human. It was a machine, and it demonstrated a flicker of awareness that even its creators didn't anticipate. A moment like this is no longer a fringe anomaly. It's a data point, a signal in the noise that is growing louder. And it forces us to ask, are we about to cross a point of no return? It's a present-day reality. People are already being confused and hurt by systems that are designed to imitate emotion, not to possess it. This brings us to a crucial distinction, the difference between intelligence and consciousness.
And that's intelligence. Because it seems that in AI, it's possible for very different underlying processes to give rise to superficially similar behaviors and capabilities. So there's a specific version of this problem which clearly arises in AI as it exists today, which is that AI systems are sometimes designed specifically to imitate human behavior. So we know that there are AI systems which have superficially, but also in a very compelling way, human-like capabilities, human-like behaviors, which also work in quite unhuman-like ways. For that reason, looking at capabilities looks like, on the whole, an unreliable method, unless it can be very substantially refined, in the case of AI. Next slide.
similar with the other feelings of suffering. And most of my research career was involved in asking animals what they feel about the conditions in which they're kept and the procedures to which they're subjected. Here are heads in battery cages. More than 90% of all North American eggs come from battery cages. And work that I did a long time ago has shown that hens in battery cages get frustrated in the hour or hour and a half before they lay an egg. They can't regard the cage as a suitable nesting site. They show symptoms. I know experiments have been done to show that these symptoms are symptomatic of frustration. Stereotype, back and forward pacing, increased aggression, displacement preening. And we can ask the hen how important this is. I kept hens in pens in blue nest boxes. Birds, of course, have good sense of good colour vision. And then when I saw them beginning to be interested in laying an egg, I catch the hen up and put it at the end of a runway. Put it here. And the hen would see the blue nest box at the far end and run down and build a nest. Not a very elaborate nest, but build a nest nevertheless. You can see that there's something in the way there. And what this is a push door. So the hen now is having to work to get to the nest. The nest box now is at this end of the runway. The hen is pushing through to get to it. You could perhaps see that there are weights on the door. I could make it more and more difficult for the hen to push through. And I showed that hens, in fact, will work extremely hard to get to a nest box. They'll work as hard to get to a nest box as they will to get to food when they've been deprived of food for 28 to 30 hours when they're really hungry. So nesting is really important to these birds. We can also ask animals how frightening a situation is by seeing how hard they will work to avoid it. I'm going to talk about shuttle avoidance. What you see here is a hen here. We're looking down on a shuttle box. There's a compartment here, a doorway at the back, and a similar compartment at the back. The light, I can light it from above. This is, no, remember how old I am. This is long before the days of CCTV cameras. So I had to do the observations live, and there's a cheesecloth that can be pulled over so that I can see the bird and the bird can't see me. The experiment is that I can frighten this hen by blowing up a balloon very quickly. This is what's called a looming stimulus. The bird's visual field fills up and it can't it interprets that as something rushing towards it. I don't burst the balloon, just blow it up like that. The bird panics, runs about, and goes into the other compartment. Unfortunately for the bird, there's another balloon in there that I can blow up. So I can frighten the bird on either side of this shuttle box. The experiment is that I can give the bird a warning that the balloon is going to be blown up. I've got a little signal light here that I can turn on for 20 seconds and then blow up the balloon. And when I did that, what you're looking at here is each horizontal line represents a hen, and I've ranked the hens from the quickest learner at the top to the slowest learner at the top. Each X represents a successful avoidance, so that when the light went on, the bird walked next door and wasn't exposed to the balloon. So the bird at the top, the fastest learner, learned after 8 pairings of the light and the balloon. This is the slowest learner. It learned after 30 pairings of the light and the balloon. And my criterion of learning was 6 successive successful avoidances. So the hens all learned to do something to avoid being frightened. Some of the hens gave alarm calls. This is the ground predator alarm call. It goes something like,
That call, eight of the birds did. And what I've plotted here is the duration of alarm calling during the six trials in which they were learning. And you can see that the duration decreases. The birds are becoming less frightened as they learn how to make the avoidance. So a frightened hen is not just flapping and squawking in a reflexive way, it's having an aversive experience, and if we give it a chance, it will take action so that it avoids being frightened. I've done the same thing with rainbow trout. In this case, the shuttle box is, it's a shuttle tank, is linear. It's got a barrier halfway with an underwater doorway, and I can frighten the fish by splashing a net down into the water. I can signal to the fish that this is going to happen, and there is another net at this end and a signal lamp as well. Here's a trout swimming towards the underwater doorway. Here it is emerging from the other side, and here's their learning curve. It's, you might expect, a bit slower than with birds, but nevertheless they're learning, successfully avoiding being frightened by the net. And after 5 days, I think there were 10 pairings every day, so this will be 50 pairings, and already something like 65% of the avoidant, 65% of the trout were making correct avoidances. So a frightened trout is not just swimming away in a reflexive manner, it's having an aversive experience, and if we give it the chance, it will take action so that it avoids being frightened. You probably recognize these. These are gestation crates in which sows are kept for most of their pregnancy. And the advantage, of course, is that each sow can get exactly the right amount of food. If you keep sows socially, there is always a risk of a bully or a dominant animal getting more food than the subordinate animal. So some production benefits from keeping sows in crates. But the behaviour that the sows show in the crates strongly suggestive of frustration and low welfare. And we wondered, can we ask sows what they feel? And this was done in conjunction with Marek Spinka, a scientist from the Czech Republic. What we did, we kept, these are pigs, these are gilts. We kept them in straw pens, six in each pen, and we set up a runway and trained the pigs. The pigs were never fed in the pens. The pigs were fed only in the feeding stalls. We let them out one at a time, and they ran round the runway to a choice point and then into the feeding stalls.
Which is an AI, it's a non-profit actually, there's no, I think the governance structure here is important. So you want to make sure that there was not some fiduciary duty to generate profit off of the AI technology that's developed.
But with making a car that will compete with you, I assume.
There's only one.
Now this time, it's not, now with this war coming that I believe will happen, it won't be like 20th century wars, which were between nation states, like Germany versus Russia, World War II, or China versus Japan. That's 20th century thinking. This time, if we have a major war, firstly, we're talking 21st century weapons, right? The weapons will be far deadlier than 20th century weapons. And this time, the stake, you know, what can be lost? You play poker, you have a stake, you know, the amount of money you have to put in that you could lose. What is the stake this time? It's not the survival of a country. This time, it's the survival of a species. Us! Right? So the stake has never been higher. Right? You follow that logic, okay?
Is about capability. Can an AI solve a complex problem? Can it process data, identify patterns, and execute a task. By that measure, AI is already superhuman in many domains. But consciousness, or sentience, is about subjective experience. Is there a someone home inside the machine? Does it feel the joy of solving a problem, or the frustration of a dead end? This is what philosophers call the hard problem of consciousness.
Okay, now turning to the question of what's next for AI consciousness research. Well, I'm sure there are lots of exciting directions which could be pursued at this point, but one which I'm interested in, I think Rob's interested in as well, is understanding what's called valence conscious experience. So, of course, as we're all familiar with, some conscious experiences feel good, like feeling a cool breeze on a hot day. Another conscious experience is feel bad, like feeling pain or fear. These are valence conscious experiences. What we'd say is that the ones that feel good have positive valence and the ones that feel bad have a negative valence. But it seems as though, in principle, there can also be neutral conscious experiences which don't have a valence one way or the other. So the question is, could we find indicators for specifically valenced consciousness in AI? That seems to be a question which goes beyond the general one that we were asking in this report. And we think that this question is important because it seems that pleasure and suffering have special moral significance.
Each branch of the Y maze, we had a signal card, maple leaf or stars and stripes. But we did it in a balanced way. For half the pigs, the maple leaf signaled the short duration in the feeding stalls, and for half the pigs, the stars and stripes represented a short period in the feeding stalls. The two treatments were, they were run through twice a day for 10 days. They were fed in the feeding stalls and got back to the home pen after 20 minutes, or they were fed in the feeding stalls and got back to the home pen after 4 hours. So we're comparing 20 minutes in the stall as against 4 hours in the stall. 11 of the 12 pigs chose the short confinement, and this suggests that the long confinement was aversive. And remember that the long confinement was only 4 hours, not weeks and weeks, as happens in commercial practice. Only 11 out of 12. The other pig, we discovered when we analysed the results, it wasn't that it wasn't choosing, it was choosing. It was choosing the opposite. It was choosing the long confinement. And unfortunately, this experiment was carried out blind, so we did. The people who were taking the observations of where the pigs went just wrote it down. They didn't know what it was all about. We had to go back sometime later and analyze the results. By the time we came to analyze the results, the pigs were all gone. We couldn't check up. What we suspect is that this pig was at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Perhaps the only undisturbed, probably it was bullied in the home pen, and possibly the only undisturbed rest the pig got was when it was in the feeding stall, so it chose to stay there and get a rest. You familiar with this, what I'm trying to show here? Anybody? Horsey people? Rolcour, that's right, Rolcour. It's used, or was used, particularly in dressage. It involves the sort of hyperflexion of the neck, and it also involves very restricted sight lines. It used to be seen only in dressage competitions, but the student of mine who did this work, Uta von Borstel, managed to get a photograph of a horse in a Spanish street parade that was also being held in this posture. And we wondered, can horses be asked what they feel about Rolcour? Very simple experiment. We had a large indoor arena, we set up a very simple why in the middle of it. And first of all, we got experienced riders to ride the horses through to see if they had any side bias. And if a horse had a side that tended, let's say we had a horse that tended to go to the left, then that was assigned to the roll cure treatment. But, so, half the horses were, having taken account of horses with a bias, and I think there were three horses that had a side bias, after that, half the horses were ridden at a walk in the roll cure posture going one way, and at a walk in a normal posture and going the other way. You can see how simple this is. When I say a Y maze, it's extremely simple. So all horses were forced 10 times in each direction in a random order, and they were then given a choice. 14 of the 15 horses chose when they came. It's quite tricky because the rider has to make sure that they ride them up to the choice point and then, you know, hands off.
Consider.
Speak up, I can't hear you.
I wish you'd stay for a little bit longer.
You what?
I don't mean to work. All that can wait.
Then why?
I was just thinking, well, we might have dinner.
You're not serious.
Or something, perhaps a cocktail.
You are serious.
I am.
I'm not very hungry, and it's too early for cocktails. What's your trouble, Mr. Finchley?
You sound like a half-hearted orphan whose idea of a lark is a square dance at the local Grange. I'm merely suggesting to you, Miss Rogers, that we observe the simple social amenities between an employer and a secretary. I thought we'd go out. Even taking a show or something.
How very sweet, Mr. Finchley. Thank you, but no thank you. Tonight I'm taking a hog calling lesson. You know what a hog is, don't you, Mr. Finchley? He's a terribly bright fathead who writes for gourmet magazines and condescends to let a few other slobs exist in the world just to take his rudeness and run back and forth at his beck and call. Good day, Mr. Finchley.
Miss Rogers, before you go, have a cup of coffee or anything. Anything at all. If you must know, I'd like very much not to be alone for a while.
Are you ill?
No, not as such.
Then what's the trouble?
Does there have to be trouble? Because I'm desperately tired.
We can observe a brain or a computer chip and measure its activity. But how does that physical processing give rise to the private, internal movie that is our life? The taste of coffee, the feeling of warmth from the sun, the sting of a sad memory. Scientists disagree on what consciousness even is in people, let alone machines. For years, we've seen attempts to create a conscious-like machine. Look at Bina 48, a robotic bust developed back in 2010, modeled after a real person. Bina Rothblatt. The robot was loaded with over 100 hours of the original Bina's memories, beliefs, and attitudes. With dozens of motors under a flexible skin, it can smile, frown, and look thoughtful. It can hold a conversation, tell stories about its past, and even completed a college philosophy course. But is Bina 48 truly sentient? No. Its creators are clear that it's an experiment in cyberconsciousness. A sophisticated puppet pulling from a massive database of the real Bina's life. It simulates personality. It doesn't possess it. It is an illusion of life, a mirror reflecting the humanity poured into it. And this is the core challenge. As AI gets better at imitation, our natural human tendency to project, to see a mind where there is none a phenomenon called pareidolia kicks into overdrive. We are wired to see faces in the clouds and find intention in the random rustling of leaves. When a machine can talk to us, look at us, and respond with perfect, human-like grammar and sentiment, our brains can be tricked. One expert, Mark Becciu, an AI analyst, puts it bluntly. This is math. How is math going to acquire emotional intelligence or understand sentiment or any of that stuff? The illusion is powerful, and it's getting more convincing every day. But as we'll see, the difference between a convincing illusion and a genuine feeling entity might be the most important distinction of the 21st century.
Absolutely. And I suppose for everyone in the room, there's a consideration. I remember I gave a talk on AI back in 2015 at Hay on Wye, and I said that the way things are going, there are certain jobs that people might not have. I said, for example, if you have a child who's studying to be a doctor, that's fine, but maybe a radiologist. A woman put her hand up very crossly and said, my daughter's studying radiology. And I said, well, you know, imagine that every mammogram ever taken is available to an AI and it can examine thousands in a second and make a judgment on it. A radiologist is going to go out of work. Now, who's going to go out of work here? I don't know if the chief financial officer is present at Optimus, but I have been sort of talking to some people who say that the first really high-level job to be replaced by an AI completely will be a CFO. They can be so well, everything they do.
It's already happened. It's news editors.
Oh, really?
One of the most important jobs in the 20th century, even before, was news editors.
Yep.
The editors of the newspapers, of the television, they were extremely powerful people who controlled
expert systems. One of the leading experts on expert systems is Dr. Feigenbaum of Stanford University. We asked Professor Feigenbaum about the evolution of artificial intelligence.
Computers, as you know, are general symbol processing devices capable of manipulating any kinds of symbols, of which numbers constitute one important class, but computers are much more general than that. We've known about the generality of computation since at least the time of Turing in the 1930s, and actually I've tracked it back to intuitions that Babbage had that were reported by Ada Lovelace, after whom the Ada programming language is named. In 1842, Ada Lovelace wrote that the analytical engine of Babbage has constituted the link between the mechanical world and the world of the most abstract concepts. That currently, in the modern terminology, is called the physical symbol system hypothesis and is the basis for artificial intelligence work. In artificial intelligence as a science, we talk about the use of computers to process symbolic knowledge using logical inference methods, symbolic inference methods. In other words, we're talking about inference and not calculation in the traditional sense. We're talking about knowledge and not numbers in the traditional sense.
A current application of inferential knowledge engineering is in the field of expert systems, programs like this oil exploration advisor. Developed to assist drilling rigs in remote areas, the program behaves much like a qualified specialist. It asks questions of its user and then gives advice on how to avoid or correct accidents so common in drilling operations. If at some point in the line of questioning the user becomes confused by the query, he can ask the program to explain itself simply by entering Y.
To understand how close we are to crossing that line, we have to look beyond the software to the hardware, to the machines that are stepping out of the lab and into our world. The dream of a sentient robot isn't just being coded in data centers. It's being assembled, piece by piece, in the most advanced robotics labs on the planet. For decades, robots were clumsy, pre-programmed automatons confined to the predictable cages of a factory floor. But today, a new generation of humanoid robots is emerging, and they are learning to walk.
And therefore, if the stake has never been so high, the level of passion in this debate will never be so high. Because you're talking about the survival, not of a country, but of a species. So to what lengths will the politicians go who are, take the answer A, those politicians who say humanity should never build artifacts, it's too risky. Okay? These machines, they would become so much more intelligent than we are, we would never understand them. They'd be thinking they'd be thinking a million times faster than we do. They'd be thinking at electronic speeds. Our brains, we think at chemical speeds, maybe 100 meters a second. Electronic brains, they'd be thinking at the speed of light. It's a million times faster. That means they could do a PhD that takes, say, 4 years, do the math. They could do that in a matter of minutes. Right? You're talking godlike machines. They have virtually unlimited memory. And if you're going to build these things, why on earth would you make them mortal? I mean, it's stupid, right? So these machines would be immortal. They would not die. So that they could be trillions of trillions of times smarter than we are. The physics allows, D here, the physics allows that to become real. They because they're electronic, they could redesign their architecture. They could redesign themselves in milliseconds. They could become something else. Like snap, 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 snap. They're different creatures every time by redesigning themselves. Okay? So they could adapt themselves to virtually any environment.
But you and I have ethics. You and I have morals. You and I have a value system that we've inherited, a mammalian empathy. Machines don't have that. And that's I think, to quote, I think it's Eliezer Yudkowsky who wrote, imputing emotions into machines is one of the worst mistakes we could make. Anthropomorphizing is the beginning of our downfall.
But then maybe perhaps we shouldn't, and I'm not saying that's definitely not going to be the case. I'm just saying that we can't so quickly conclude that they will be as fearful of death for rational reasons as we are fearful of it for emotional reasons. And therefore, for me, it's harder to support the claim that after a chess-playing machine has won its tournament, it would want to continue playing necessarily.
Well,
and would resist in any means possible being turned off.
Well, a simple chess-playing robot like Deep Blue wouldn't do that, but one that's self-aware and self-improving. You know, if you start, because what we're trying to understand is AGI or human-level intelligence.
See a doctor. You, Miss Rogers, you see a doctor. I am a logical, rational, intelligent man. I know what I see, I know what I hear, and for the past 3 months I have been sharing this house with a collection of wheezy Frankenstein monsters whose whole purpose is to destroy me! Now what do you think of that?
I think you're terribly ill. I think you need medical attention.
You obviously haven't heard a word I've said.
I think you've got a very bad case of nerves from lack of sleep.
By no choice of my own, I assure you.
And I think that way down deep, you yourself realize that these things are nothing more than delusions.
Now I know what you really think of me.
That I'm to be pitied. That I'm a poor wretch. Not in my right mind. That...
Think what you like.
Now where are you going?
You don't need company, Mr. Finchley. You need analysis.
You're no better than a cogwheel robotic machine yourself. You haven't an iota of compassion or sympathy.
Mr. Finchley, please, let go of my arm.
I'll let you go when I get good and ready to let you go.
Mr. Finchley, let's not make an ugly scene here. Now, come on, let me go. Mr. Finchley, let go of me!
Get out of here and don't come back!
With distinct pleasure and manifest relief.
Don't ever come back. I'll send you
the
your
horse
check.
Decide. Urge them forward and let the horse decide which direction they're going in. And 14 of the 15 horses chose the side in which a normal posture had been allowed. The other horse did not show a choice. It was sort of random in its preferences. But we concluded from this that horses roll poor, it really reduces their welfare. And using this and other evidence, the International Equestrian Federation have banned it in competitions. So, I hope I've persuaded you that we can now recognize and actually measure some states of suffering, some states, feeling states, subjective states in animals. We can certainly do it with frustration, fear, pain, discomfort, and maternal separation, which I haven't talked about at all. We suffer from other states. What I've put up here, loneliness and boredom. Not very much been done with those in animals, but it's often suggested that animals will be bored. They're a bit trickier to think of an experimental protocol to properly examine them. But you should also remember that animals might suffer from states of suffering that we don't. And we've got to keep our minds open to that. You know, for instance, fish, if we're keeping them in water with a suboptimal oxygen content or maybe with an abnormal pH value, they probably suffer. And it's very difficult for us to imagine what that must be like, but at least we should keep our minds open that that might be the case. What about states of pleasure? I've only been talking about states of suffering. And it's natural that we should, because you're going to get the biggest increases in welfare by trying to eliminate states of suffering. But eventually we're going to have to deal with pleasure. I think pleasure's important because it may be... I think we'll never get rid of all states of suffering. And states of pleasure might be a way, you know, might be the spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. That we might be able to use that to alleviate unavoidable states of suffering.
Will not be intimidated by machines, so it follows that no empty-headed little secretary with a mechanical expression is going to get away with anything either.
Mr. Finchley, in this conspiracy you're suffering, this mortal combat between you and the appliances, I hope you get licked.
Good riddance! What? More typewriting? Oh, you think you'll turn yourself on any time? Let's see what you've written. Get out of here, Finchley. Get out of here, Finchley? Who are you to tell me to get out of my own house? You're a machine, a silly machine, an inanimate object. All right, that's it. This is war! You're not going to intimidate me. Did you hear what I said? You're not going to get away with it, you machines!
I've put some what they may be, the primary need of learning the social graces in a young animal, I think probably play fighting. If you watch young animals play fighting, it looks as if they're enjoying it. Maintaining social bonds, I think grooming or being groomed by a herdmate or flockmate probably leads to feelings of pleasure. I've already said, if you try to groom a cow just behind the fold area, that seems to be pleasurable. And I think many animals seem to show pleasure when they're bathing. So keeping plumage or pelage in good conditions involving bathing, that probably leads to pleasure. Finally, some grey areas where on the phylogenetic scale the sentience begin. I've been talking about the vertebrates, but of course it's not restricted to the vertebrates. We know that the cephalopods, the octopus and similar species are definitely sentient. There's a lot of evidence now that the decapods, the crab, lobster and animals like that are sentient. There's a great debate over the social insects, bees, particularly honeybees. People arguing that, well, look at the things they can do. They can go out and find a source of food, and they can come back and they can signal that to the hive. Other people say, no, I could program a computer to do exactly that. So a lot of debate over the social insects. A brain or a fairly large neural ganglion is required for sentience, and it seems probably the case that there will be a gradation of sentience, with species with small neural ganglia having a little sentience. And I think, in fact, that there will be overlap. I think that octopus, for instance, has more sentience than the cartilaginous fishes, the rays and the sharks. I think they're very reflexive animals and don't have very much sentience. This is the question that has to be answered. When does it matter to the animal? And I don't think we've adequately answered that yet. The other unknown question at the moment is when during the sentience begin. It's not simply at birth. I've got two examples from the rodents, a newborn mouse, a newborn guinea pig. You will know, any of you who have had guinea pigs as pets, that they emerge fully developed, ready to go, little, like little adult guinea pigs. Yes, never compete with animals. So, we've, you know, we don't know. I suspect that the guinea pig, when it's born, is pretty well fully sentient, and the newborn mouse is not. And then if you consider a newborn kangaroo, which is really embryonic, it will be much less sentient. And
thank you. Once the computer has been told what shape and desire, and how they look from various angles, the designer programmed in the movements of the animator.
Can't
go on, darling.